Welcome to the Institute of Coaching's Mindfulness Podcast. We appreciate you joining us today to learn more about mindfulness and its role in coaching. I'm Dr. Susan David, co-director of the Institute of Coaching. Today, I welcome our special guest, Dr. Russ Harris, author of a number of books, including the best-selling and fabulous The Happiness Trap, and a leading authority on mindfulness. Today, Dr. Russ Harris shares his expertise with us on the science and benefits of mindfulness and how it can be applied practically and effectively across health, personal, and executive coaching. Welcome, Russ.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
That's a pleasure. So I think what would be really useful for our listeners is to start off with a definition of mindfulness. I know that there are a number of definitions and a number of theoretical perspectives on mindfulness. So what would you describe as your definition of mindfulness?
Well, I think what all these definitions boil down to is actually something very simple. I define mindfulness as paying attention with openness, curiosity, and flexibility. So firstly, it's an attention process. I think pretty much every definition agrees on that. But it's not just about paying attention. There's a particular attitude, a particular quality of attention. Firstly, it's about paying attention with openness. I'm open to my experience. I may not like it or want it or approve of it, but I'm open to it. I'm not turning away from it, denying it, trying to escape it. Secondly, there's an attitude of curiosity. I'm curious about my experience. I'm curious about what is happening here, curious about my thoughts or feelings or curious about the world outside me. Again, even if I don't like it or want it, or approve of it, I'm curious about it. And thirdly, it's about flexibility of attention. At times you might have a very narrow focus, at other times you might have a very broad focus. At times that attention may be directed internally towards your thoughts and feelings. At other times it may be directed externally to what you can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell in the outside world. And most commonly it's kind of straddling both the interior and the exterior world. So paying attention with openness, curiosity, and flexibility. Lots of definitions include the term in the present moment, but it's superfluous. You can only pay attention to the present moment. You can't pay attention to the past or the future. You can only pay attention to thoughts about the past or the future that are showing up in the present. Another term that's often thrown in there is non-judgmental, but I'm not overly keen on that because it tells you what it's not but doesn't tell you what it is. Okay, so it's not judgmental. What is it? Well, it's open and it's curious. And also the other problem with the term non-judgmental is it creates the idea that judgments are absent when you're mindful, but it's not the case. Your mind continues to create judgments. It's just that you are detached or diffused from those judgments rather than getting caught up in them. So I think basically, you know, that's a good working definition, paying attention with openness, curiosity, and flexibility.
Fabulous, Russ. That's really helpful. I know that you trained as a medical doctor, so I'm interested in how you came to use mindfulness in your research and in your practice as it's now evolved.
Sure. Well, look, to be honest, I've never done any research. I have somewhat of an aversion towards doing research and avoid it as much as possible. But I'm very grateful that lots of other people do it. I like to read what other people do. But in terms of practice, basically working as a family doctor about 20 years ago now, we're talking, I became very interested in a new branch of medicine called psychoneuroimmunology, which is the study of the mind and the nervous system and the immune system and how they all interact. And at that time, there was some very interesting research coming out from mindfulness-based stress reduction, the program pioneered by Jon Kabat-Zinn, which kind of showed the benefits of mindfulness meditation in all sorts of areas of health and well-being. And so that's how I first got interested in the idea. Of course, back then, I was only aware of mindfulness as a sort of meditation practice, whereas now, 20 years later, I have a very different take on mindfulness.
I understand that you no longer practice as a medical doctor, so I'm wondering if you could describe a little bit about your practice and the kinds of clients and populations that you work with and how you use mindfulness in that context.
Well, my practice has changed enormously over the years. What happened was that I became increasingly interested in the psychological aspects of health and well-being, and increasingly disinterested in, you know, the writing of prescriptions and the treating of the physical aspects. And ultimately, I left medical practice over a decade ago. It was sort of a gradual transition. I started doing more and more counseling and therapy and less medical practice. And for about 6 months, I was holding on to doing just a three-hour shift once a month as a family doctor, because I was still kind of attached to, I couldn't let go of that part of my self-image. And then finally, October 2000, I said, no, that's it, just let it go. So for the last decade, I've been working with two hats on, psychotherapist and executive coach. So I deal with the whole range of, human psychology, from, stressed executives at work and to people suffering from depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, and addiction. And in fact, I don't really see a distinction in terms of mindfulness between coaching and therapy. It doesn't matter if the thoughts you're getting caught up in are, I'm going to screw up my presentation to the board of directors, or, I'm going to kill myself because life's not worth living. We're going to use the same mindfulness processes to help you step back and unhook from those unhelpful thoughts. It doesn't matter if it's the anxiety of public speaking or if it's an overwhelming fear of rejection. We're going to use the same mindfulness processes to help you accept those unpleasant feelings in your body, make room for them without getting pushed around by them. It doesn't matter if you're dealing with, painful memories of the Vietnam War appearing as flashbacks, or if you're dealing with the embarrassing memories of your last performance appraisal. We're going to, again, teach you the same mindfulness processes to help you unhook from those cognitions and engage in the present moment rather than getting pulled back and caught up into the past. So I actually like wearing those two different hats, but at the level of process and what I actually do, there is no distinction between them. It's just the content of the thoughts and feelings that varies a bit.
What is it that you actually do when you're working with a client and you're working in the context where mindfulness is something that is useful to bring to bear on the issue that you're dealing with? What are some of the techniques, strategies, or even conversations that you might be having?
Sure. Well, before I answer that, it's probably important to explain a little bit about the model that I work from, because it's not just purely about mindfulness. I work from a model which in the world of therapy is called acceptance and commitment therapy, and in the world of organizational and business coaching, we would call it acceptance and commitment training. It's abbreviated as the word ACT. And so the ACT model is about both mindfulness and values-based living. The aim that we're looking for with all our clients is not to solve any one particular problem, but to develop something called psychological flexibility, which is the ability to mindfully act on your core values. So it's about, clarifying your values, using your values to set goals, using mindfulness to help you engage fully in the present moment, using mindfulness to help you deal with the inevitable, negative thoughts and painful feelings that are going to show up along the way and act as barriers. My work, mindfulness without the values doesn't really mean very much. So my starting point with any client would be actually clarifying what their values are, what sort of human being you want to be, what you want to stand for, what you want to be about with your time on this planet, what you see as the discrepancy between the way you are behaving and the way you would ideally like to be behaving, and what kind of barriers are getting in the way of you being the person you want to be and doing the things you want to do. That would be my first starting point. In terms of where the mindfulness comes in, as I'm talking to you on the very first session, I'm wanting to gauge how present you are. Are you all caught up in your thoughts? Are you drifting off? Are you easily distractible? Are you struggling with your emotions, or do you seem to be kind of very present, grounded, centered, engaged? So I'm kind of making an assessment about your level of mindfulness even as we talk. And I'm going to ask you specific questions about what kind of things, you know, what stops you from doing the things you want to do or from being the person you want to be. And you're likely to give me a whole bunch of different thoughts and feelings that are getting in the way. So I'll start kind of making a sort of inventory of the thoughts and feelings that are likely to act as barriers to you if you respond to them on automatic pilot, if you just let these thoughts and feelings push you around without any kind of awareness of that process. And then we're going to start introducing mindfulness as a way to help you overcome those barriers. I mean, obviously, it depends on the presentation of the client. If it's a performance issue, we're going to talk about how mindfulness is an essential component for peak performance. Task-focused attention, the ability to absorb and engage in the task is kind of, I would put out there, you know, at the core of peak performance in any area of human endeavor. If it's a relationship issue, then we'll talk about mindfulness in relationships and how important it is. If you're not paying attention to someone, how can you read their body language or gauge their emotions or even make them feel that they're important and cared for if you're not kind of giving them this full mindful attention? So we may do a little bit of, education about the benefits of mindfulness and its relevance to the particular presenting issue. There is no one approach fits all, but usually those are the kind of two ways that I would introduce mindfulness, either as a way of overcoming psychological barriers, particularly difficult thoughts and feelings, or as a specific skill to enable performance enhancement or resonant relationships.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I'm wondering, I work with a lot of CEOs and senior executives, and I'm wondering what your experience is of how they react to the concept of mindfulness in a coaching context.
Well, very positively. I don't know what the situation is in America, but certainly in Australia, mindfulness is the flavor of the year, really, flavor of it's the new sort of zeitgeist or zeitgeist, however you say that word, and so there's a lot of buzz about it, but still, there are still plenty of people for whom it's new, and so I sort of describe it to them as it's like a special mental state of awareness and openness and focus, and most people, like that. It's kind of, oh yeah, I'd like a bit of that. And then I usually put out there that it's mindfulness has been around for thousands of years, but until very recently in the West, we could only learn mindfulness through ancient Eastern traditions such as yoga or Tai Chi or meditation or martial arts. But now, due to models such as ACT, we can all learn these skills pretty quickly just in the space of a few minutes. And then I'll usually take them through, a couple of brief 1 or 2 minute mindfulness exercises to give them a taste or a flavor of what we're doing here. So when it's couched in those kind of terms, when we divorce it from meditation or exotic Eastern practice and just kind of sell it as a simple mental state of awareness and openness and focus. I haven't encountered a negative reaction yet. Like, who wouldn't want that?
You mentioned the concept of meditation earlier. Is your experience that coaching clients have a difficult time separating the concept of mindfulness from the concept of meditation?
Not if you explain it. Unfortunately, many people talk about mindfulness and meditation as if they are one and the same thing. And some of the most popular mindfulness-based approaches place huge emphasis on meditation, such as MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Whereas in ACT, we use the term mindfulness skills. Our stance in ACT is that meditation is one way amongst thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of learning these very useful life skills. And so, you know, look, if you are willing to do meditation or yoga or tai chi or martial arts or any of those kind of ancient practices, fantastic, good on you. Those are, you know, there's lots of evidence to show that those things are really helpful and they're great ways of building mindfulness skills. And at the same time, let's be realistic. Most people are not going to be willing to do those things, at least not in the long term. So let's be pragmatic. Let's look for lots of other ways that you can develop mindfulness skills without having to make such a huge commitment. So my kind of stance is, yeah, if you're willing to do it, fantastic. But if you're not willing to do it, hey, you know, there's so many other ways of developing these skills. We don't need to meditate. And there's enormous relief on people's faces usually when you tell them that.
And that is such a beauty of mindfulness, which is that you really can do it wherever, whenever.
Exactly.
You mentioned a little earlier that you work both in therapeutic and executive coaching contexts. I'm wondering if you can talk mindfulness across those two contexts, whether there are differences that you bring to bear or whether they are really largely similar, as you mentioned.
Yeah, look, to be totally honest, at the level of content, they seem to differ, but at the level of process, there's no difference. You know, what our society has become obsessed with creating different types of mental illness. The DSM-4, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, when it was first created about 40 years ago, only had, you know, less than 50 different diagnoses. Now there's over 400 different types of mental disorders, and drug companies are very invested in kind of maintaining that there are some people out there that are mentally healthy and others who have mental illness. But this is really a bit of nonsense. You know, the same processes that you see going on with someone with severe depression are the same processes that we can each find in our own lives. What have you got in depression? You've got a disconnection from your values. You've got a lot of action that is ineffective and not values-oriented, a kind of procrastinating or moving away from important areas of life. And all of us do this to some extent in our life. What else have you got in depression? You've got a lot of fusion with unhelpful, negative, self-defeating thoughts, beliefs, and ideas. And all of us will, to some extent, fuse with this sort of stuff. What else have you got in depression? You've got something that ACT calls experiential avoidance, the ongoing attempt to avoid or get rid of unpleasant or unwanted private experiences, such as thoughts and feelings and emotions. We all do this. It's just... But what gets called depression, the person is a little bit more extreme in their behavior. They're kind of in an attempt to avoid unpleasant feelings of anxiety or fear of rejection or fear of failure. This person is avoiding the big challenges in life, leading to kind of closing off and staying home and, you know, opting out of life. But all of us do this to some degree. It's just a matter of degree. And so, you know, it's an illusion that there, you know, that there are people out there that have mental illness and other people out there that are mentally healthy. It's a continual spectrum of the human condition. And the very same processes that you will find in the, you know, the homeless, schizophrenic, drug addict, you will also find those same psychological processes in the highly successful CEO of a multinational corporation. It's only a matter of degree. So that is why ACT can go into organizations and professional sports teams, and it can also go into prisons and hospitals and working with severe mental illness like schizophrenia. We're doing the same processes, each human being. What are your values? What do you want to stand for? How do you want to behave? What do you want to be about in the face of your challenges? What are the thoughts you're fusing with? What are the feelings you're struggling with? Help you engage in the present moment, unhook from unhelpful thoughts, make room for difficult feelings, and take action guided by your values.
Thank you so much, Russ, for sharing your rich experience and insights with us. To all of our listeners of this first part of the Institute of Coaching's Mindfulness series, we hope that this has made a valuable contribution to your thinking and coaching practice. We now conclude part one and welcome you to listen to part two, in which Russ will share applications and techniques for understanding and practicing mindfulness. Thank you.